Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I mean, what's that football focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team.
I would be very careful about slinging stuff.
Am I going to get sued?
Is that legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
It's all coming up Chicago at the moment. Sure, they got only their third win of the season, but it can sign the Carolina Panthers to their eighth loss of the season and actually enhance Chicago's chances of getting the number one overall pick, which now stand at over 40%. Talking about that, talking about the game last night, talking about some New York Giants strategies going forward, and the boo-boo breakdown, all the injuries you need to think about this week, will be myself and Brad Spielberger. How's it going, Bradley?
Like you said, everything's coming up Chicago. So, you know, a nice field goal win over the 1-8 Carolina Panthers. It doesn't get much better than that, does it?
Just living the dream, baby. Just living the dream. We'll get to that pretty soon. But first, we got to hit talking about securing your family's financial future, starting with life insurance. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it quick, easy, and affordable to protect your family so you can get back to enjoying life. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high-quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Fabric has flexible policies that fit your family and your budget with quality policies like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. Get your personalized quote in minutes and then apply when it's convenient for you. It's all online and on your schedule. You go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in minutes at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/PFFNFL. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company. Not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. All right, Brad. Other than victory, what was your takeaway from this epic Thursday night football encounter?
I mean, I know the stretches of opponents over the last month or so for the Bears have not been the greatest offensive teams across the league, but I do think you are seeing this defense start to play at a much higher level. I mean, you look last night, they technically gave up 6 points on the two field goals because we had a punt return from Mir Smith-Marset. And you look at the Raiders game, the Chargers kind of killed them, but the Raiders game, the Vikings game, you go back a little bit now, and particularly against the run, they're a top five team against the run right now in EPA per play and success rate, and you saw that again last night. Basically nothing on the ground for Carolina, which they kind of tried to lean into early, get Chuba Hubbard going, and he was averaging like 3 yards a carry. So, and then beyond that, again, this season is more so than wins is about seeing growth from young, recent draft picks. I thought Kyler Gordon, the Bears' nickel corner, was arguably the best player on the field last night. Maybe Derek Brown, maybe some other guys had some splash plays throughout the game, but Kyler Gordon was everywhere in coverage, up against the run, had 6 defensive stops or tackles for loss or no gain. He was awesome.
Yeah, no, I think the Bears had some, good performance on defense. Certainly Montez Sweat brings just a competence to the defensive line that they didn't necessarily have without him. Like, Sweat, I don't think, is an amazing player, but he's good enough that if you give him opportunities, he's going to get pressures. You know, and he had 7 pressures on 34 pass rushing snaps. 34 pass rushing snaps is a lot, but he returned 7 pressures with it. Like, it's an important element that they're bringing to that defense that they didn't have without him. But, you know, we talk heading into that game, right? Steve was saying he likes good defense. He likes defensive battles. But there's a difference between good defense and bad offense. And I think last night, unfortunately, was kind of what people expected going into it, which is we've got two fairly incompetent offenses going against each other. That's going to lead to some low-scoring affair. At least Chicago could run the ball, which the Panthers couldn't even do. And that, honestly, was probably the difference between the two teams.
Yeah, no, it's a good shot, right? It was probably one of the worst, you know, games of the season, just in terms of the quality of moving the football that we saw. Back to Montez Sweat quickly. I mean, yeah, like, he's always a guy for us that his pressure rate's going to be higher than his pass rush win rate. He's not necessarily going to be winning a bunch of one-on-ones, but I think if you go look at all 3 sacks the Bears had last night, Montez Sweat was a factor in all 3 of those guys getting home. And the Bears don't blitz. They're 29th in blitz rate. It's going to be a 4-man rush, guys that need to win, and, you know, kind of goes against what he does well. But nevertheless, a lot of those coming against Taylor Moton as well, who's a pretty good pass-blocking right tackle. So, but yeah, the offense was a journey, was a struggle for both teams, no question about it. But yeah, Deontay Foreman, revenge game, staying out of the chains, running hard, running downhill. It was enough in this one.
Yeah, obviously the quarterback competition, Tyson Bagent, I mean, you know, you got to win. That's about all you can say from the Tyson Bagent perspective. But Bryce Young, another game that wasn't particularly good, was more concerning than good. There were a couple of small, like one nice pass on the corner route to Strawn, a couple of nice scrambles, but that was kind of it. And where I think this game was more concerning relative to his season otherwise is, like, that offensive line has been a train wreck for most of the season. It was okay last night in terms of pass protection anyway. Like, it wasn't like he was running for his life every single play. He was under pressure little bits and pieces, but he didn't handle whatever pressure was there particularly well, and there wasn't the kind of volume of pressure that he's had in previous games. I mean, Ike Ekwonu gave up one hurry, which is like a season, you know, good game for him. The fact that the offense still looked that bad versus with a better pass protection was a real worry.
Oh, 100%. And I talk about how the Bears' run defense has been good. Their coverage unit is a bottom 5 statistically, you know, so far this season. So it was interesting, too, because you mentioned that the bomb to Strahan or Strawn, however you say it, down the left sideline on the corner route, that was off play action. And coming into this game, Carolina, I think, was dead last, if not bottom 5 in play action rate. And probably part of that because they don't trust the offensive line to hold up, or maybe they don't really trust Bryce to turn his back to the defense, right, and then have to, you know, relocate, process, find someone downfield. But that was his best. That was the best throw that anyone made all night. And they did run it, you know, more than their season-long base rate had been. But if you're in a matchup where you trust the offensive line, given the opponent, which this game obviously would apply, you need to lean into that more, because they're doing a lot of the high-low, half-field read concepts, all of those things. I think it makes more sense to continue to do that off of play action, especially because, you know, they are a threat to run the ball a decent amount. I just thought they could have continued to lean into that. But yeah, I mean, the play that was emblematic to me of what's going on in Carolina, it's 2nd and 16. Bryce Young is standing 6 yards into his own end zone and throws a curl to third string running back Raheem Blackshear, who literally lined up out wide and ran. Like, that is the most emblematic of, like, well, I mean, he didn't look good. He hasn't looked good all year. But, I mean, what is the guy supposed to do in this current environment?
No, it was it wasn't good at all for Carolina. What did you make of Tyson Bagent, I guess, for another game for him? This time he gets a win. You can talk yourself into being encouraged by what you see from Bagent, given his story, given his background, given all those kinds of things. He's a strange quarterback, though. Like, there's some, he gets mocked a lot for not having a strong arm, but it's in very specific situations where he has no kind of arm. It seems to be when his feet are under him, his arm's fine. He's got zip on the ball. He can put it deep enough down the field. It's the second he's, like, falling away from the throw or his feet aren't where they're supposed to be. Not only does he not have a strong arm, but, like, there's nothing there.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not trying to be mean to the guy when I talk about it. I'm more of just been kind of mocking it because people keep pointing to this like combine test, I guess, where they I'm sure he took four hitches and put his entire body weight into the throw. Remember, everyone always talked about it with Baker Mayfield too. Yes, if the guy can take four hitches and put his entire 200 pounds of weight into the throw, I'm sure he can zip it. But the screen pass to Darnell Mooney, for example, you're talking about his feet were not set and it fluttered in there, and basically Mooney had no chance of doing anything with the play at that point. He made a couple nice throws. Look, the fourth down throw over the middle to Tyler Scott was also his furthest throw of the game, 15 yards downfield. Obviously, the game clincher. I was honestly surprised that they even trusted him to drop back and throw the ball on third and six. And he, I wouldn't say threw it into traffic, but I mean, Darnell Mooney did have two guys closing in, and there was decent velocity on that throw. He also led Mooney upfield, and I think it helped generate that first down because Mooney had to kind of run forward to go get the ball. So there was some good there, but end of the day, like, I'm not trying to be mean to the guy. It's more just like, look, he's not a long-term starter. I'm pumped as a Bears fan. He should be the backup for his entire undrafted contract and be a dirt cheap backup quarterback. It's just like, let's pump the brakes on him being like a potential starter in Chicago or anywhere.
Yeah, you mentioned that one screen that fluttered. There was like two or three more of those plays though later where, again, it's like, They both came when he was throwing left, the ones after that, where he's sort of falling away from the throw, and as soon as his feet are not under him, the ball just dies. Like, it doesn't get anywhere near where it's supposed to be at. We were talking about this recently, about a quarterback who's like that, whose arm is good when his feet are set, but is terrible when they're not. I can't remember who it was, but Bajan's got that same thing, where I actually think his arm is decent when he's got his feet under him and he can put the ball in there. But as soon as it's not, it's like, it's the other end of the spectrum. It's catastrophic. It's bizarre. I agree with you. Like, I think he's a great story. You know, it's a huge leap. They were showing you, right, the graphic of like teams he was facing in college and then the NFL teams that he's facing now. Like, you go from Colorado School of Mining or something to the Minnesota Vikings, right? It's a pretty big leap. He's going to have a growth curve attached to it. But I think we're seeing enough limitations that we're not getting out of control and saying, yeah, he's the guy to focus on. Forget Fields. You know, he's the starter. Like, he might be a backup.
Yeah, we also look like I do think he processes well. I think he's not like, you talk about the footwork a lot, and there were a couple happy feet throws, but honestly, I think when he does have confidence in the pocket, I think he'll stand in there. I think he will plant, he'll square his shoulders and be solid. But we also saw last night, and I don't know if it's a product of him not trusting himself or what, but Tyler Scott on a corner or a post route over from the right slot was wide open for a touchdown. And then Darnell Mooney, of course, the Chicago horrendous all 22. We couldn't really see. I was watching Prime Vision, which is my favorite because you can actually see if there are any DBs behind the guys. Anyway, he had the prime target, the green highlighted circle, so I trust them that he also was wide open when Bajan was rolling to his right. And he didn't throw it either time. And it's like, does he not trust that he can get enough, you know, air under the ball or what? But no, he's solid. I think he knows what he's doing. I think he's calm. I think he's composed, which says a lot. You know, like you said, going from, you know, IUPUI, which is like a 15 seed in the NCAA tournament every year, and Colorado School of Mines, to now playing in the NFL. But yeah, there are obvious limitations.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I think that's all the time we deserve to give to this game, to be honest. You know, Thursday Night Football, the Bears move one step closer to the number one overall draft pick and get a W. So, you know, can't ask for much more than that from a Chicago perspective. We are going to talk a little bit about where the New York Giants go from here, given their disastrous season, given their quarterback problems as well. But before we do that, we got to talk to you about DraftKings. Who are the pretenders? Who are the contenders? We're more than halfway through the NFL season, but DraftKings Sportsbook is still pumping out unbeatable offers every single game. New customers can bet $5 to get on anything to get $200 instantly in bonus bets. DraftKings isn't stopping there. All customers can take advantage of a sweetener offer every game this October. Get in on the football action with DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the app now and use code PFF. New customers can bet $5 on anything to get $200 instantly in bonus bets. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with the code PFF. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for a problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino Resort, Kansas, licensee partner Golden Nugget, Lake Charles, Louisiana, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See sportsbook.draftkings.com/football terms for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, Bradley, the Giants have made an unholy balls of this. Where do they go from here?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they are a very, very legitimate threat to be picking top two. You know, Arizona gets Kyler Murray back now. I mean, Carolina, it looked horrendous last night, so they probably should be in the conversation for Chicago, obviously. The Patriots, I think, are an interesting one as well. But there's a very legitimate chance I think this Giants team is picking in the Caleb Williams and Drake May range of the draft. And they effectively gave Daniel Jones a two-year contract. All the guarantees, all the full guarantees from the first 2 years. There is an injury guarantee that could kick in for the third year. He presumably would be healthy with the ACL before that comes. And it does complicate matters if you wanted to trade him, you know, with, okay, was a team going to give you that much for a guy coming off a torn ACL with some big money and guarantees owed in the second year of a deal? But I think you have to if you're the Giants. And I get the argument of they're still so far away. There's so much more they need to add to this team. But, you know, I think you just have to do it and build around a new guy. In theory, Andrew Thomas and Evan Neal is a decent bookend to start building around if Neal can play some better football, if both guys can get healthy. And then, yeah, I mean, a healthy Wandale Robinson now, Darren Waller, and the whole team is injured. But long answer short, I think you have to do it and take one of those top prospects if you're there.
How damaging is it for the new regime, Joe Shane, Brian Daboll, to effectively 1 year after making a fairly significant decision, right? Like, we'll talk about the decision itself in a second, but 1 year after essentially getting it wrong, going back to ownership and saying, we got it wrong. We're going to go in a completely different direction. We're blowing it up. We screwed it up last year. And now, Jones isn't the guy. We're drafting the new guy. Now we have to get rid of Daniel Jones. Like, how hard is that for them to go kind of cap in hand to ownership and say, we blew it?
Good question. And you do wonder, you know, to what degree ownership is involved in. I view this situation particularly interesting. I think part of why they made this decision, and I think it's very bad process, and I am in general a fan of Joe Shane. I think he's done a lot of good. We should get to the Leonard Williams trade in a second here. I think the viewpoint was, and I have a feeling ownership probably had something to do with it, we need to keep both Daniel Jones and Saquon Barkley on this team, and if we're going to pay one a multi-year deal, I guess let's do the quarterback buy low. He obviously got extended before all the 2020 class guys got way more money. Like, you could talk yourself into why it made sense to pay him and franchise tag Saquon Barkley. Flash forward, you know, Daniel Jones is not worthy of the extension. Saquon Barkley is below league average in explosive run rate and success rate in stuff rate. Like, neither guy really needed to be retained, frankly. But that is what I come back to is ownership, I imagine, was like, find a way to keep both guys. And he said, okay, we're not going to give a running back a big second contract. We'll tag him, and that means we have to pay Daniel Jones. So that's kind of how I view it.
So if you were the decision maker there a year ago, where was the mistake? So what was the actual original sin in this whole thing? Because there's a cascade of problems that all stem from whichever screw up you determine was the first one or the biggest problem they made, they had a sequence of decisions. Number one was, when they come in, do we pick up Daniel Jones' fifth-year option, right? That's decision number one. They decided not to do that. Once they got a pretty good season out of Daniel Jones coming off the first year with Brian Daboll, the playoff run, winning a playoff game, then the decision is, well, what do? We've got Daniel Jones expiring. We've got Saquon Barkley expiring. We have one franchise tag. How do we deploy this? They end up deciding to sign Daniel Jones to a contract, giving him multiple years, and then using the tag on Saquon and negotiating that way. So what, in your opinion, was the mistake, and what should have been the actual way to go?
No issue declining the fifth-year option. Now that those are fully guaranteed at exercise, I think more teams, frankly, should take the risk of, all right, we don't really know what we have, and the downside risk of fully guaranteeing $23 million, whatever it was going to be, we'd rather have the risk of, okay, now we have to tag him for $32 million. Yes, we're losing $9 million, which is not ideal, but we're also not, let's say he was horrible last year, and then you're on the book sitting there like Sam Darnold in Carolina with a $19 million fully guaranteed fifth-year option that you would give away for a fresh bag of football. So it's like, I think that decision is fine.
Right.
The issue for me was that, you know, analysis I just thought of the two players. Look, I get Saquon Barkley is a franchise cornerstone. He matters so much, this community, the organization, everything. The franchise tag was created for Daniel Jones 2022. It's literally why it exists. Is, hey, we had a quarterback who threw 15 touchdown passes and had like seven big-time throws and a 6.5-yard average depth of target. And yes, his offensive line was not good. His receivers were not good. And yes, he was great against Minnesota in that playoff game. But like, we need to see more. We don't know if he really is the guy. And to clarify, like, we're not, the ACL injury sucks, but he was not playing well before that.
Right.
But I feel bad he's injured. I would like to see maybe he could bounce back. But anyway, that's why the franchise tag was created. And I mentioned Barkley hasn't been great, but if Jonathan Taylor is signing 3 years, 42, I feel like 3 years, 37 and a half was probably a realistic contract for both parties in this Barkley Giants situation. You're comfortable giving 1 year 11. All right, give him 37 and a half with $20 million guaranteed. Again, like, what's the difference? You know, I think that if I needed to keep both, I probably would have gone that route.
So I agree. I think that the way they handled it, the franchise tag thing, was the mistake. I also agree that I think turning down his fifth-year option was a fair move at the time, right? They effectively said, look, if he stinks, we want rid of that. We'd have no idea what he is. If he's good, we can put the franchise tag on him anyway. So, yeah, it's costing a little bit more, but we're paying for the next year of seeing, right, without any kind of cost. So I agree. I think that made sense. But the second he had the season he did, which is a step forward, but we don't know, you put the franchise tag on him because you can't risk doing anything else. Because if you get it wrong, exactly what happened will happen, right? He plays badly, you want rid of him, and you're stuck with him because you just gave him the other contract. So did they misevaluate what Daniel Jones was coming out of this unexpectedly good year for the team, right? Playoff run, winning a bunch of close games, beating the Vikings in the playoffs, and him playing well while they did that. Did they like misevaluate because of that that unexpectedly good performance, or did they just get greedy and think, we need to keep both of these guys here and this is the best way of doing that? Like, we, in order to have the flexibility of signing Daniel Jones, getting Saquon Barkley locked down because that's a more contentious contract or whatever, like, we need the franchise tag for him and this is just the best way of doing that, and we want to have our cake and eat it.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of both. I do think that the latter is a big part of it, and really teams should learn from this of, like, never be backed into a decision because you need to retain a tag for one other player. It's just not a good process. But I also think it was a misevaluation. Like, again, I said, he didn't have good protection, didn't really have good weapons last year, and this is unfair analysis. But you take out two games against Minnesota, who may have had the worst defense in the NFL last year, and he probably had like eight touchdown passes, so like on the season. Like, I, you know, that's not the correct number, but you know, a team that sat back in soft zone and did nothing, that obviously changed coordinators, is now playing much better. I mean, he owes Ed Donatella a chunk of his signing bonus, I think, frankly. So, yeah, it was just a bad bad decision in every way you look at it. But I will pivot to the positive. The smartest thing they could do, in my opinion, was recognize it in other ways and kind of hit the reset button. Getting a second and fifth round pick for a player in Leonard Williams that is good, but not great, that is 29 years old, that is not franchise taggable because he's already been tagged twice, I think was excellent. I think it was the move of the deadline. Was the Giants handling that? I think it was better than anything anyone else did at the deadline.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. That's an indication that they're going to head in the right direction and recognize where they are. But the last sort of question that I end up with, if they misevaluated Daniel Jones, if they screwed it up last year, if they sort of misread where they were as a team, is there not also a chance that they're going to do that again this year and say, the offensive line was abysmal, we still don't have receivers for Daniel Jones, the man got injured, like, we're stuck with him anyway. Let's give Daniel another shot. Let's go get Marvin Harrison Jr. at the top of the draft. Let's go get, you know, one of the top tackles, Fashanu, Alt, whoever. Let's the Evan Neal thing didn't work. Let's build around Daniel Jones and give him a real chance this year.
I think it's possible for sure. I wouldn't be shocked, frankly. I mean, they would probably tell themselves, all right, let's say they do have a first or second overall pick. We can trade this for a crazy boatload of draft picks. We can still land, if not Marvin Harrison Jr., you get one of the other awesome receivers that should go in the top 15 of this class. And then, more offensive line, everything. Just build the entire offense out, maybe add some pass rush, whatever, on the defense as well. I could see it. And there's an argument to why it makes sense. Personally, I would take one of the quarterback prospects and just go from there.
Oh, I absolutely would as well. I'm just sort of, yeah. I think we're taking it as read that Daniel Jones coming off this year, that's it, right? Done. The end. Like, you can't possibly go forward with him at this point. But I'm conscious of, I wouldn't have done what they did last year, and they're the ones whose names are tied to that decision. Like, I keep coming back to this idea of, it's got to be pretty hard to go into the ownership room with your pitch is essentially, hey, we misidentified our franchise quarterback a year ago. Let me fix it by identifying the next franchise quarterback. And you're like, the first piece of information works quite heavily against the second piece of information in that sales pitch.
It certainly does. It's a good point. I mean, look, Steve Keim pulled it off, and, you know, obviously he's no longer in Arizona and made some poor decisions along the way, but probably the best thing he ever did was admit that Josh Rosen was a whiff and say, look, we're going to take Kyler Murray and start this thing over. So that's where I go back to. I do think we've seen a lot of good process from Shane. I think a lot of things he's done have been smart and show a macro understanding and a path and a vision. But yeah, it was a miss on the quarterback evaluation, on giving him that deal. I think there's no way around that. But also, like, every team kind of does that. You say, well, the alternative is we take a risk on a rookie that might not be good, or, you know, it's a safe play, it's a high floor play, which you could probably even argue that with Daniel Jones. But yeah, I don't know. I hear you 110%. I would give another shot. He inherited the guy. He declined his option. He changed his mind because of a situation with Barkley that, for all we know, you know, maybe ownership was pushing that more than we realized.
Right. I think you're right that, look, I don't think the Cardinals get enough credit for the Kyler Murray move, actually, to be honest. I think there are a lot of teams that would have passed and said, no, we got year one for Rosen was awful, but we drafted our guy in the first round. We believe in him. He's going to be the guy going forward. We're going to trade out at number one. We'll pick the picks up. We'll build around Rosen, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't. They looked at that and said, even though we drafted a guy last year in the first round, this guy is so much better than the one we drafted. We don't get this opportunity very often. Let's make it happen. The difference there, though, between that situation and this one is those were two rookies where the evaluation, everyone sort of acknowledges that the evaluation is a little bit of a shot in the dark. We don't really know what any of these guys look like until we get in the NFL. This, they had like NFL, you know, a run of NFL footage and a year in the system with this guy and decided he's our guy. And then a year later, and it costs money, like a lot of money. And then a year later, they're like, actually, you know what? Nah, we got it wrong. We blew that one. We missed. He's not the guy. The money we talked you into giving up last year, sorry about that. That was a mistake. But now we're going to go in a different direction and draft the guy instead. It's the right call. I'm not arguing against it. I think that's absolutely what they need to do. And acknowledging the mistake is the first step on the road to putting it right. But that's a tough conversation with the owner, right?
Super tough too, because like, let's say Jones did play the rest of the year, just didn't play well, or you know, maybe had injuries but not a torn ACL. Not that a neck injury is any less serious, but you know, he didn't have a 9-month recovery type of injury. And also, of course, this injury happened in the pocket, but which kind of seems to be the case for all these recent mobile quarterbacks, is they actually don't get hurt doing that mobile thing we all fear. But like, Jones is not probably going to use his legs as much, at least for the next, 2 years of his career. And Jones not having the threat of taking off with the football, I mean, that's the best thing he had going for him, you know, the last couple of years, is that opening throwing windows and getting respect and having, you know, linebacker spies and stuff like that, because he is taking off and running. It is tough. You know, the money is very different with a Josh Rosen 10th overall pick, right, versus now an extended guy you're paying $82 million over 2 years. And that's the toughest part about it, is the trade value is probably, because like, you could go ownership, say, yeah, we paid a lot, but we're going to save half of it. We're going to, you know, I think it's like 35 for next year, and we're going to get a second and a fourth. Now it's like the team's going to ask us to retain half the salary, and we're still going to get like a third. I mean, that's just kind of off the top of my head, but it's tough. No question about it.
I think the thing that makes that, if you were on the fence about it, the thing that would settle the decision for you is, we did see what this offense looks like this year with non-Daniel Jones quarterbacks, and Tyrod Taylor looked better. Like, you know, and so you could probably talk yourself into, if they'd seen nothing but Daniel Jones this year, you'd be like, look, the offensive line is garbage. It's historically terrible, right? It's one of the worst offensive lines we've ever seen. The receivers are doing nothing. We don't know if that's Daniel Jones' fault or not, but we can at least make the case. The receivers aren't helping him out. You know, Darren Waller got hurt, as always happens, so he didn't get his guy that we thought he was going to have. What could he do, right? This was just, he was in a no-win situation. But he saw him get hurt, and Tyrod Taylor comes in, and okay, it's not like Tyrod Taylor lit up the league, but it looked better, right? It was visibly more effective, more efficient. It moved the football better. He made more big throws deep down the field. Suddenly, Jalin Hyatt looked a little bit more like training camp Jalin Hyatt rather than regular season Jalin Hyatt with Daniel Jones. It's difficult now to construct that argument in a completely sound way that doesn't put any blame on Daniel Jones, right? We've seen we can change a guy who the league has determined is not capable of starting, really, and he makes it look better. That's a pretty big indictment on the guy we have under center. It's got to be at least part of his fault.
Fascinating, beautiful irony of the whole thing is that exact quarterback in Tyrod Taylor had a Daniel Jones-esque season in Buffalo,
right,
where Joe Shane was a high-level ranking personnel person, makes the playoffs, also had 15 touchdown passes, also a good runner, all those things. And they said, thanks for your services. We're going to go draft Josh Allen. It was the exact same scenario as Jones last year.
And I also think, you know, now we're in this world where the goal for quarterbacks used to be, let's just get a serviceable starter. Because if you didn't have that, you had nothing. You had an absolute disaster at quarterback and you couldn't function in the NFL. Now, finding those guys is actually really easy. And the goal is finding Mahomes, finding Josh Allen, finding Joe Burrow, like finding an elite guy that can move the needle, to the point where I'm actually wondering if there's even a difference anymore between serviceable starter and backup. Like, they're the same guy. Andy Dalton came in, who is now a backup quarterback, and he looked better than the number one overall pick in a single game, right? Tyrod Taylor has looked better than Daniel Jones. Does it make any difference whatsoever if Jameis Winston is the quarterback as opposed to Derek Carr in New Orleans, right? I actually think now the line is gone, that if you have a serviceable starting quarterback, you have a backup quarterback, which means a guy that can start games, but you don't want playing for, you know, three seasons in a row because he's not as good as the elite quarterbacks that you need to win the game. Like, I don't know if that line exists anymore.
You mentioned Andy Dalton. He was probably better than Derek Carr in New Orleans last year. Like, you know, with all kind of the same construct, same receiving group, same offensive lines, you know, Pete Carmichael calling plays. Yeah, it's a great point. It really is. That middle tier, we've been saying this forever, and you know, Jason Fitzgerald over the cap been talking about this for a decade, but that middle tier of quarterback that gets, let's say they're 50% as good as Mahomes, but they get, and that might even be generous, but they get 75% of the money of a Patrick Mahomes, because the way the market works, it's the worst place to be.
Yeah, but I think now the line, so there used to be, you know, tier one, your elite high-end quarterbacks, and then like tier two, where you could win with them, but it was harder, and then tier three, which was like, you know, marginal starters, backups. Either tier two has been erased entirely, and they just don't exist, or the line, like that is a really small group now, and tier three has come right up to meet it. And now what you have is tier one, those like top 10 elite quarterbacks, maybe not even 10, you have the young guys who are probably in their own tier entirely, but like guys you think can maybe get into that tier, so we have hope attached to them. And then you have the tier three guys or tier two guys who are just everybody else, and basically like QB 14 through 38 are the same person. It doesn't matter who you have. It's just get one.
Actually, no, it's a very, very good point. I'm wondering what line is blurred. Like, you know, okay, Mahomes, Allen, whoever you want to put in that top cluster. But then the next group of like your, you know, right now, Trevor Lawrence, your Dak Prescott's, like those guys, I think maybe are like the separation between them and the Derek Carrs, whatever's is larger. And I think, like you said, 14 through, yeah, you said it perfectly. 14 through 50 is the same.
Right. Like, I mean, you know, Geno Smith is playing, has this incredible sort of resurgence of his career, right? But he's also thrown a DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, now JSN, you know, and is still putting a ton of turnover-worthy plays up in the air. Like, is there actually that much difference fundamentally between Geno Smith and, you know, pick your quarterback that's a marginal starter slash backup and is just not having his run right now? We're in a weird world where I think that distinction has actually been erased, and that's the indication that you don't have the guy and you need to start over.
Yeah, and we are in a league now where if you want to win the big ones, you need to have one of those cyborgs. Like, yeah, you can make the playoffs. And, you know, obviously teams aren't always just saying Super Bowl or bust in every single decision they make. But more and more and more, I think teams are going to shy away from buying into, you know, the Daniel Jones type, Derek Carr type signings. It's just you're not getting return on investment in any way, shape, or form.
All right, Brad, I think that's going to do it for the moment. We're going to kick over for the famed Boo Boo Breakdown, which hopefully soon will be an award-winning Boo Boo Breakdown. If we win an award, then everything becomes, you become award-winning, Brad, award-winning podcast guest. So we're going to head over to the Boo Boo Breakdown, and I'll talk to you next week, Brad.
Good.
All right, back in the studio as ever on Friday is our medical expert, Vic Troha. How's it going, good sir?
I am doing great today. How are you?
Not bad, not bad. All right, let's fire through some of the week's biggest injuries. I want to start with the Bengals because there's a couple of guys there. Jamar Chase, the first one. Mm-hmm. Chris highlighted this, you know, on the broadcast when it happened. He fell from a height going up to get a ball, fell sort of onto his back. And Chris was talking at the time of, you know, how sore that's going to be the next morning. Mm-hmm. Is this just what we're dealing with, general soreness from cracking your back against the turf, or is there a real risk of him not playing and not being himself if he does play?
Yeah, that was funny when he was commenting on that, too. It's like, oh, he's going to feel that tomorrow morning, right?
Yeah.
It looked at first like it was just a really hard impact injury. To me, there's no structural damage as far as like worrying about like the vertebrae being injured or anything like that. This is just an acute low back injury, and actually, studies show that it's only going to take the proper management and a short period of time to heal from like an acute back injury where your muscles are just flared up. So I think that he's going to be fine. What you're going to see is he'll probably be put on like a heating pad in between series on his low back just to keep the muscles relaxed. And then he might be even doing some mobility exercises or stretches if it starts to stiffen up. But In totality, I don't see it being like a long-term issue. It's just one of those acute injuries where he's just going to be really sore.
Then you get T. Higgins, who shows up in the injury report with a hamstring injury. Yeah. I saw somebody, I forget who it was, referring to T. Higgins as something of a, you know, a Ferrari, a sports car, a guy that's finely tuned, but he's going to spend some time in the shop every single season.
Yep.
And this is his time in the shop. Presumably, given that it showed up relatively late. I mean, he's not going to be playing with a hamstring injury.
Right. Well, you know, Sam, one of the things that I look at is if a player is midweek and they show up on the injury report with something that wasn't previously an issue. So sometimes you'll see, like maybe somebody with a soft tissue injury get like a Wednesday injury report, but they were dealing with it the previous week. You can kind of chalk that up as a rest day.
Right.
But where it's a new injury and it shows up midweek, that's when you get more concern, especially with something like a hamstring. So what probably happened is he probably strained that at practice, and this is going to be way too much of a risk for them to put him in this weekend. I would only see that he would come in the sense of they were just taking a lot of caution with it, but I don't see that happening. I think he's going to be out, and they need him down the road anyway.
Yeah, I mean, something like a hamstring injury, if that shows up out of the blue midweek on an injury report, I mean, there's just no way that you're cool that it's fine for the Sunday. Like, you're if he felt it during the week, you can't possibly go out there and sprint, you know, on a go route on a Sunday a few days later. You've got to give it the rest, right?
Absolutely. You felt it during the week at a practice, and then you're going to try to go into game where you can't even replicate those type of reps. I definitely see him taking the rest on this. If he does go out there, studies show that there's probably about a 23% chance of injury risk with that. So it's really going to be up to the medical team and T. Higgins on how he really feels coming in this weekend, but I see him holding out.
So then you get Justin Jefferson, who's now been he's in that practice window. He's almost back. They are unlikely, I think, to play him this week. Right. I think Kevin O'Connell has basically said that would be pretty aggressive, throwing him out there this week. He himself, I think, was sort of saying he's either 80 or 90%, or maybe it was 70% or whatever it is, which I still don't understand as a concept. I mean, it's either it's back or it isn't. 70% of a hamstring is no hamstring.
Yes.
Like, that's not being able to sprint. So where are we on Justin Jefferson and his hamstring, which was bad enough to dump him on IR?
Yeah, since he went on IR and they're getting him back to practice, it's a good sign that he is back now, because that means that they're not going to try to hold him out past the bye, which I believe.
Right.
The 100% thing basically tells you that he's still dealing with some soreness or apprehension to like really stride out, because your hamstring is maximally contracted and needs all of that strength and like an 80 to 100% full sprint. Well, what do wide receivers do on go routes? What do they do when they break into a post? They're going onto that full sprint. So if he's not feeling comfortable doing that, or if he has any lingering effects, then he's going to probably hold out this week, which is understandable. And then we've talked about this in the past too, is the Vikings are surprisingly in a spot where they might be in playoff contention, even with Dobbs. Like, I do think that he's going to want to come back for a potential playoff run and not want to risk it getting back a little bit early.
They're only a game and a half back from the Lions.
I know,
threw that graphic up last night of just what the NFC North looked like with Chicago obviously playing. It's like, wow, from being the Vikings might have a shot at the, you know, one of the top picks in the draft a few weeks ago, they're all of a sudden only a game and a half back from the Lions at the top of the North. They're still right back in it with their schedule is still pretty soft for a while. It's crazy how they've
stayed
in
there.
It's
going to be interesting to see what they do for sure.
But another player that they've lost in this is Cam Akers, who now popped his other Achilles. How does that happen? How does one guy tear both Achilles in this course of a couple of years?
Man, well, the studies that relate to actually tearing your other Achilles is hit or miss. It's only about like a 5% chance, but 5% is kind of a lot, because it's not like the average person has a 5% chance of tearing their Achilles, right?
Right.
But
what is the average, like, what's the just incident rate of tearing an Achilles?
Well, like minimal, very right. Like under 1%.
Before, like, what's it like? Is I presume it's higher for, you know, an athlete. Like
an athlete, right. An NFL player, yeah, for sure it's going up. I think the thing that this tells you, though, is that because he tore his other Achilles, it could have just been like some type of compensation issue that was never noticed. When you tear your Achilles, it's interesting because the rehab that goes into that needs to withstand so much load that they say about 2,200 pounds of load that need to be able to go through that tendon. So what might have happened is that he was kind of rehabbing that one side and really focusing on his one Achilles, when his other Achilles really wasn't being focused on at all. And then now that he was back and playing, it just so happened that the stronger side is actually the one that was torn, and this is the one that broke. I feel bad because at his age and his likelihood of coming back right now is pretty tough.
Right. It makes it kind of fascinating with him being like, remember his return the first time was like 9 months or whatever mm-hmm. it was, like, and everyone, he was the first kind of like, what the hell, this timetable for an Achilles return makes no sense, right? And now we're getting Rodgers, who's trying to come back within the same season. But like, Cam Akers was the original like superhuman return from an Achilles injury, and then he tears his other Achilles. It's this fascinating mix of, on the one hand, you've got evidence saying there's something wrong with his Achilles. Both right. of them have gone. And on the other hand, you've got evidence saying he did return from one freakishly fast. So
yes.
I don't know what to make of his like prognosis in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, is somebody susceptible to like a bilateral Achilles tear?
Right.
Maybe Cam Akers is. But I mean, this is just my opinion from seeing the film. He wasn't the same player.
Sure.
You know, and so that's another thing is he wasn't the same player, but he's still trying to go at that 100% at a really aggressive sport. And it could have just been that it was a fluke and he ended up tearing his other one too. So we don't really know.
I don't remember how he did the first one, but from memory this time around, like, it was, he was kind of backing up. It wasn't like, you know, his body was kind of used to all of the work being done by the repaired Achilles mm-hmm. when he puts both feet on the ground. And, you know, that's where it was one leg going backwards and sort of absorbing the whole load. And then the Achilles just snapped and over he goes. So, like, I can't see a world where compensation is really relevant here, because you're not going to be making the original or the healthy, quote unquote, Achilles worse by
right
building up the other one, right, building up the strength of the other one. It's just somehow when the load is put through this one, I don't remember, as again, don't know how he did the first one, but when the load is put through this one and his body just went nope,
yeah,
not happening.
Wasn't that mechanism kind of interesting to you too? Because like you look at Aaron Rodgers and his foot was planted and he got landed on, and like I texted you, I was like, that's his Achilles, right? Well, this one was,
this is the injury that terrifies me. This is the injury, like, when you are young, you don't think of these.
Uh-huh.
Like, you never consider the fact that one, at some point, your body is just going to say no to the movement you're trying to make and will not do it, and will something will break. You never factor that in until it happens to you. And then from that point on, now you're aware of all of the things that can happen. Now you're like, there's all kinds of crap I can ask my body to do, and it'll just say, not a chance. Nope, something snapping instead.
Right.
Like, it would never occur to me that just sort of bouncing backwards, you know, backing up, catching a ball, planting my foot in the turf, that your Achilles is just going to snap and say,
yep,
I'm out. Tapped out.
This is that one where, like, you're
horrible,
stepping off of a ladder, and you're like, I got to be gentle here, like, because I'm afraid of something like that happening.
Exactly. Forget that. This has to be why when they come back, they're not the same guy, because how can you possibly ever do the same things you've been doing without thinking about it again? You're like, I was just backing up, and I felt like I got shot in the back of the leg.
Yep.
Like, I'm never, ever going to get back to not thinking that's a possibility again.
I mean, how many times has he done that, right?
Right.
So, and how many times would we be asked to do that again?
So, exactly. Before that moment, it's literally a watershed moment. Before that moment, he's probably never thought that that's a possibility before. And then after that moment, he's never going to think it's not a possibility again. Like, I can't see a world where that wouldn't affect how you would play once you're back, even when it is theoretically 100% healthy and ready to go again.
Especially on both legs.
Right, now. Poor guy.
Yeah.
All right, Dallas Goedert.
Yeah.
Dallas Goedert's injury was interesting. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like that tackle should be illegal.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of the old school horse collar tackles that were made illegal because Dallas safety Roy Williams, amongst others, would do it all the time, where you'd grab a guy, you know, in the neck roll and basically fall down on his ankles.
Right.
And that was breaking ankles regularly. So they're like, this is a dangerous tackle. You can't do it.
Yep.
Well, whoever was making the tackle on Goddard basically grabs his arm, pulls it this way, and then falls on it.
Yep.
I mean, that's like, if you were trying to break his arm, that's how you would do it.
That's how, exactly. It's almost one of those where you look at it and you just realize like that person took whatever limb was there and put all of their force down and landed on it.
And I understand that the reason he did it is because Goddard's out here trying to stiff arm him. But like the mechanism to deal with that is not, I'm going to take the stiff arm and snap it. It's, you know, swat it down and then try and get into the body and take him down that way. Like I feel like that should be an illegal tackle.
Yeah, well, and you definitely have a valid point when it ends up that he fractured his forearm, right? So, like, that's even a worse outcome. He didn't, like, he just, like, sprained his wrist. But the interesting thing is, like, this isn't that bad of an injury. So you hear fracture, you hear radius where that radial head fracture can happen, and it was on a fall on an outstretched hand. We call it a Fuchs injury. But he's going to be back in 4 to 6 weeks. I just think that he's going to have to recover a little bit from just the surgery, but he's going to be able to stay conditioned, which is nice, and he's going to be able to do some other like football-related drills with his lower extremity. It's just that he's going to have to take off with his upper arm. It's kind of like what happened to Zach Moss, right? And he comes back, and you don't even see really a relatively difference from previously being injured. Same thing with Dallas Goedert.
Does that get any sort of enhanced like protection once he's back? Does he wear any kind of like not a cast, but some kind of splint even when he's back and ready to go, just to reinforce the repaired bone?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they put like just a basic wrist and brace or splint on it, even with like a thumb strap on. I wouldn't be surprised, especially if he still has some tenderness in there. And that might be just something more mental for him to, you know, put something on because he has had that previous injury, but it's not going to be needed. Like, they will not put him out there if he needs to have any type of stability on a broken bone relying on that brace.
All right, anything else we want to hit before we get out of here?
Let's see how Kyler Murray does this week. First week back with his ACL. I'm interested to see how he does scrambling on that knee, and hopefully he comes back as agile as he was before.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit yesterday. Cardinals coaches seem to be suggesting he's going to be running as normal, but that's the thing to keep an eye on, right? Not just how good does Kyler Murray look, but A, does he want to scramble? B, do they want to tap into his ability as a mobile quarterback? Because that's a big part of his game.
Yeah, definitely watch for it.
All right, that'll do it for the PFF NFL podcast this week. Thank you all for listening and watching, and we'll be back on Monday.